Good evening, and you're very welcome to this special broadcast of Arena from the Cúirt International Festival of Literature here at the Nuns Island Theatre in Galway. Coming up on this evening's programme, we talk to the writer Patrick DeWitt about Sensitive Cowboys. Emer McBride tells us about her head-turning debut novel. We have music from Maria Doyle Kennedy, and we'll hear from the recently crowned Poetry Grand Slam champion of 2014. But first, an American writer whose second novel, The Flamethrowers, was a finalist for the 2013 National Book Award in the United States. It was also a New York Times bestseller. Her debut novel, Telex from Cuba, was published in 2008, and she is the only writer to be nominated for a National Book Award in fiction for both her first and second novel. Please welcome Rachel Kushner. Rachel, the debut novel in 2008, Telex from Cuba,
yes,
was published when you were 37. So what role would you say writing had played in your life up to that point?
Well, it had played a pretty big role in my life. It's not a short novel, and took me 6 years, actually almost 7 years to write it. I'd, you know, gone to school to study writing, and then I worked as an editor in New York City, because it's difficult to live in New York City without having a job, you know, unless you're born to live there without having a job, which I wasn't. And I wanted to write a novel, but I worked full time, and I worked on writing in the morning, you know, get up at 5 a.m. and write, and eventually quit my job and lived on savings and wrote that book. But it took me a long, long time to write it. I mean, there was a time in my 20s when I wasn't totally focused on writing novels. I was doing some other things. But I, you know, writing had always been important to me. It was something that I wanted to do with my life. It just took me a while to figure out what my form was and what the theme of my first attempt at that form was going to be. And, you know, it's a steep learning curve, and that novel takes place in a world and in a time that I did not personally inhabit. And so I had to really subject myself to, you know, in a pleasant way, to an entire literary history and political history, and then separate from that in order to write the book.
So in the terms of writing then, Telex from Cuba, did you do an awful lot of research before there was even a word heading towards a page or a finger going towards a typewriter or a word processor?
Yeah, I did. It was very different because my new book, I didn't do that at all. I just wrote the book, you know, drawing upon worlds of knowledge that I picked up along the way as a person living in the world. But the first book, I applied myself totally to trying to understand this incredibly Baroque political history of Cuba, which is a fascinating place. Their history is incredible. And I spent quite a bit of time in Cuba talking to people who had lived there when the Americans were, in essence, sort of the rulers. I mean, it was almost a colony of the United States. So it's got an embattled relationship to American culture, as you might imagine. And people had very interesting things to say, those who remembered that time. And so that was an important aspect of my research. And then I just read a ton. I read everything, and I traveled all over Cuba. But when I went to write a novel, research is, I needed to understand everything in order to form the book. But writing a novel is something else entirely. So I had to really disconnect from everything I'd read and kind of go freehand with it, if you will. Because, you know, a novel has to be built on its own internal energy, and you only want to include those things that the novel calls for. Not to sound like a mystic, but, you know, it's not just a representation of history. It's something else entirely. And that's probably what took me the longest.
When it came to the second novel then, The Flamethrowers in 2013, you say that the process there was very different.
Yeah.
The research process wasn't quite the same. There are sort of two worlds in The Flamethrowers. There's the world of the 1970s art scene in New York, and there's also the world of motorbicycles in Italy. And
yeah.
In particular, the Valero motorcycle. What brought you to those two worlds? Had you familiarity with either of them in any particular way?
Yeah, I had lots of familiarity with both. The book, it was kind of, in a way, my gift to myself after writing my first novel, Telex from Cuba, because I found a way to sort of activate bodies of knowledge that are my own. And so I was able to write with, you know, a decent amount of authority about things without having to go look anything up, really. It wasn't about research at all. The New York art world of the 70s is something I was exposed to as a small child. I have some relatives who are artists and had been taken to New York City and driven around a truck in Soho by my cousin who worked for the artist Richard Serra and was part of this kind of uber macho masculine world of artists who get drunk and beat each other up and break all the furniture in a house. And then when I was an adult and I moved to New York on my own, I wrote about started writing about contemporary art. And the 70s it's very important time, even now, in contemporary art. You can't know about contemporary art and not know who the significant personalities and the main arguments of the 70s were. So I picked up certain amount of knowledge about that time, but also about the kind of codes and social manners of the art world. When you meet artists, you see the way they perform themselves for you. So I wanted to write a book that would recreate that world and be a kind of homage to it. The Italy part, it's complicated, but I focused on the year 1977. And in Italy, that year is incredibly significant because the state was really almost torn apart by a huge mass movement in Italy that involved not just the kind of classical factory workers and students and the whole challenge of getting them together, but people from all walks of society. And they rejected everything and descended upon the streets of Rome on March 12, 1977 with the demand, "We want everything." And I know a lot of Italians who were involved in that movement in various ways. I knew some people that were involved in the darker, more clandestine elements of it. And I thought, these two things are going on at the exact same time. This kind of rich explosion of new ideas in the art world in the 1970s and something much more serious in a way in Italy. And the challenge was to put them both in the book and figure out if they were related and in what ways.
Sitting beside Rachel is the Canadian writer Patrick DeWitt, whose second novel, The Sisters Brothers, was nominated for the Man Booker Prize in 2011. Your novel, Patrick, brings us into the world of sensitive cowboys. How familiar are you with that particular world?
Well, I was unfamiliar when I started writing about them because I hadn't really seen them before, which was my motivation. By the end of the book, I was fairly well acquainted with them.
You started with those two words, I believe. It was actually sensitive cowboys. How did that phrase come to you? What was it that made you think about that as a starting point for The Sisters Brothers?
Well, like most writers, I carry around a notepad and I jot down ideas as they come to me, and most of them, almost all of them, are unusable. I think I was watching a Western with my father, and it occurred to me that you very rarely catch a glimpse into the interior life of the cowboy or gunslinger, anyone in those, that sort of a whole Western myth. It's very much an exterior life. You're judging them by their actions as opposed to their thoughts. And oftentimes they do seem a little bit insensitive. So, and by sensitive, I was thinking of neurosis in particular. So anyway, yes, watching this film with my father, I think, was the jumping off point.
And I suppose the two really sensitive cowboys that we meet are Eli and his brother Charlie. Well, is it arguable that Eli is the more sensitive of the Sisters brothers? Their second name is Sisters, which is really confusing. Did you enjoy actually having that confusion in the title?
It wasn't the original. I sold it as it was called The Warm Job, which the publishers were happy with the book, but they came back. They had a meeting with the sales department, and they said, "Is this a book about a massage parlor?" I said, "No, it's not." And they said, "Well, we need to change the title." And I couldn't come up with a title. And actually, my editor, Lee Boudreau at Echo, came up. She said, "Can we just call it The Sisters Brothers and get on with our lives?" But once I realized that their last names were Sisters and that they were brothers, I did get a little bit of a kick out of it, sure.
How different are the two brothers? We should explain, these are sensitive cowboys who go around killing people for a living.
Yeah, well, I think they're as different as night and day, or as most brothers are. You know, I think of my brothers, and we're all extremely different. And Eli is introspective and thoughtful and concerned about his appearance. He's worried about his weight. He thinks he should maybe diet a bit. He is empathetic, and Charlie is essentially a sociopath, I'd say. So.
And did you was part of the reason of writing about sensitive cubbies, did you want to humanize these killers or understand their mind? Is that what it was about?
No, the reason when you write down these ideas and some work and some don't, and it's mysterious to me. I don't know why those two words led to my writing a book about these two men. I don't have an interest in Westerns particularly. But sometimes these seemingly modest ideas, you sit down to actualize them and there's just an inherent energy there. And this is one of those examples where just from the very first moment, it was like a bright light for me. And, you just, when this happens, you follow it to the end.
What about that, a starting point for you, Rachel? Is it similar to what Patrick has described to us, that there are many, many ideas out there, none of which get beyond a simple idea? Or was it more focused in that respect for you?
Slightly different, but I love what he said about an inherent energy. It's exactly right for me. I always call it tone. And I can't write anything until I find the tone and sort of slip into the register of the book. And that's where everything can happen. But in terms of subject, I've written two and I'm working on a third book. I pick a subject and then I just doggedly follow it to the bitter end. I don't sort of search around and try out different things. When I finished Telex from Cuba, I knew right away I was going to write this book about the New York art world. Then the whole Italy thing came in and the book expanded because I like to allow myself to work on big canvas. Maybe that's why the book is not a kind of, very particular, focused, one subject, two cowboys. But that reminds me, I keep thinking of that song, Cowboys Are Secretly Frequently Fond of Each Other. Do you know that?
I don't know.
Oh, anyway. But so, yeah, so it, and I don't, so I don't sort of pick up a lot of different ideas along the way and then work on one or two. I somehow just go with first thought, best thought.
The other way in which you differ, Patrick, from Rachel is the research process, certainly in terms of Telex from Cuba, where Rachel had all of this research done beforehand and in some ways threw it out and got down to writing the novel then. In the case of the Sisters Brothers, you wrote the novel and then went off researching particular things afterwards. One that I remember is toothpaste plays a very important role in the story.
Mm-hmm.
But when it came to the research for that, just tell us what you had to do after the novel was written and toothpaste was a central part of the narrative.
Yeah, well, I did sell the book again without having done any research, really, or minimal research. And I remember with my first book, I was with a different publisher and I had this man that came in and he knew every fact that there is to know in the world. And I just assumed that that man would show up and help me with this book. But he never did show up. And so it was sort of left to me. And so I just went through the book and there's not that many factual statements in the book. A lot of it's pretty non-factual, but whenever it came to any sort of factual, historical statement, I would go look it up. If it was correct, then that was fantastic. And if it was incorrect, then I would consider what the book would be like if I removed it. And sometimes I would keep the incorrect fact in, which was a big relief. It was a concern for me. And I thought, well, if something's incorrect, you have to take it out. And then I realized that that was not true at all. It's fine if there's incorrect facts in a book, as long as it's not being portrayed as a book that is, adhering to the facts. So with the toothpaste and the toothbrush plays a big part in the book and it had to be in the book. And I remember dreading looking up the history of toothpaste and toothbrushes.
We should explain that the book is set in the 19th century.
Yeah, 1851. And not even so much that they had to exist, but they had to be somewhat arcane. They had to be just coming into wide use. And that was more or less right. I kind of fudged it a little bit, but I just sort of took a leap and left it in there because it was that important to me.
Have you any facts that are in there that are not necessarily real facts, Rachel, that they fit into the tone of the book, as you have mentioned there, but whether they're factually correct or not, it's not important. Have you come across that type of feeling?
I guess it's sort of important to me that the book is factually correct. Maybe in a different way. I'm working in a sort of different register than Patrick. But the, you know, the, it's a world that is a parallel universe to our world. It's not the Valera family, as you mentioned, this industrial family who make tires all through the 20th century in Italy and motorcycles after the First World War. It's not a real company. It's, you know, the whole thing is made up. It's fiction. But in the larger sense, it sounds like an easy way out. I want the book to synthesize certain historical truths. I take history seriously, and I wanted to do something with factory politics and futurism. These are real things, and by using certain details from them in a precise way, I feel like I can build my own false and imagined world. So I don't really play fast and loose with details. But you know, there's an attention that one reader might have over another to that level of detail where they would find something that somehow jarred. Some woman wrote me like this very long letter. It's about, I have a whole riff about these bags. I'm sure you've seen those big square plaid bags. They're are kind of stateless people all over the world travel with them. And some people use them as laundry bags, and you can put them on a cart and push them. You know, you see them in South Africa. I mean, in Africa, South America, all over Asia, I have a guy riffing about who is making those bags because they're making a killing. Turns out they're made in China. And this woman wrote me this long letter saying, I believe the first one of those bags didn't actually appear until 78. But the riff in the book takes place in the spring of 77. And she was very upset about it. And that's a moment when I thought I'd draw the line. You know, it's fiction.
Well, I kept waiting to meet that person because there's so many anomalies in my book, and I was sure that there was going to be these sort of book-wielding fact maniacs.
Thankfully not.
Tracking me down. It turns out nobody really cares, which has
been
nice.
Those of you out there with a problematic fact, please not today.
Keep it to yourself.
If you could keep it to yourself. We will come back to Rachel and Patrick, and we'll bring debut novelist Emer McBride into the conversation later in the programme. Sitting at the table beside Rachel Kushner and Patrick DeWitt is a debut novelist, Emer McBride, whose novel was this week shortlisted for the Bailey's Women Prize for Fiction, previously known as the Orange Prize. A girl is a half-formed thing, is the title of the novel. And Emer, how many lies do you have in your novel?
It's all lies.
Give us a sense. I suppose one of the really important things in your novel, I think, is the style and the form in which it's written. What were you trying to do with that? Describe what it is and what were you attempting to do with that, would you say?
Well, I was, a starting point really was Joyce and an interest in Joyce and then in modernism. And I started to get a bit frustrated with the notion that all of modernism had already been done and was covered and neatly closed in by Joyce at one end and Beckett at the other. And I didn't think it was true, and certainly not for a lot of female writers. So I thought I'd have a go at that.
When people hear Joyce and modernism, they think of stream of consciousness. You talk about this isn't stream of consciousness, stream of pre-consciousness.
Well, I'm trying to get that one to catch on. I think parts of the book are about trying to bring the reader right inside the character and to experience everything that she experiences, but really at the point before it's thought. So it's not what's going on in her head, it's what's going on in her body, what's going on completely inside of her before the point where she can even put it into words herself.
I guess the best thing we could do is to hear a section which might give us a sense of the way you've gone about doing it. Where are we at in the book? Do we need to know much about where... She's an unnamed character throughout.
She is.
Where is she at this point?
Well, at this point, it's towards the end of the book, and her brother is very ill, and her relationship with her brother is central to the whole novel. And this section is really just about a dream that she has. I dream of creeping under. I dream of underground, where the warm earth is, where the fire goes, where we're asleep, creep you and me in holes, in burrows, rabbits safe from rain, roots growing caverns round our heads, and blind as mice popped out and new and cling and soft our bright pink skin. Who's there? There's no one. You and only me. We sing, we lilt our chamber, no one coming, and we lie 1,000 years of sleep, and get beards, wrinkle old and small and wee, troubleless in our deep. Eat the earthworms, fat slugs, things within, but I dream. Roots come growing, slowly and tangle in, and roots come more, and fat and thick, and roots come fast, roots fast in, roots catch us, roots that want our head, our eyes. We move about. The trees will have us, have our brains for no one in, that the trees will have us, roots growing in and bursting through our skulls, through and through our brains, seeking out our noses, seeking out our eyes for, strangle, choking out the air, mangle organs, tangle pain with us, the worming earth, grown through, pin us into soil, grow life around and choke the air, claw us, snare us, grow through our hearts, working through our lungs and brains, and we and fight and we howl, to silent, to no more, make us dead, make us into mud, rotting in the down, rot in the deep, turning into stone, dust we were, dust return.
Emer McBride reading from her novel, A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing. Emer, we've heard the different routes from writing on the page to publishing. The writing of this book was very swift.
That's right.
So tell us about that and then about the route from there to getting it published.
Well, I'd been, like Rachel, working towards writing a novel for quite a long time before I was able to sit down and write the novel. And I'd been doing a lot of terrible temping jobs because you also can't live in London unless you do a lot of other things to pay the rent. And my husband got a job directing a show in Japan, and he said, when we come back, whatever's left of this fee, we're going to use as writing time. So however long we can make the money last, that's as long as you've got. And so I had 6 months in the end. So I wrote it in 6 months, and I did three drafts in 6 months. And then started to send it out.
And what was the reaction and what was the feedback at that point?
Well, at that point, everyone loved it and said, this is great, but we have no idea how to sell it, so go away. And
well, at least that was truthful.
Well,
because they loved
which
the
helped
novel,
a lot.
But saying that they can't sell it, I suppose.
Yeah, well, yeah, I didn't really believe them, but their marketing departments were very sure they were right. And so that's how it went, and went on for about 5 years of, you know, getting closer, or people saying, yes, we will. And then their marketing department vetoing it. And so then I put it in the drawer and I thought, OK, I'm going to get on with the second one because I'm really wasting my life with all this rejection business, and really gave up on the thought of being published until we moved to Norwich. And one day my husband was in the bookshop there and got talking to the guy behind the counter, who said, what does your wife do? And he told him the whole tale. And he said, oh, that's very interesting. We're thinking of setting up a press. Do you think she'd let us read it? And I said, grand. And I let them, and I thought, I'll hear no more of it. But they came back and they said, yeah, we think it's brilliant, but we have no money and we're just about to publish our first book. When we have some money, can we come back again? And I said, yeah. And I thought, I'll never hear from them again. This was a story I'd had many times. But about a year later, they came back and said, OK, we're ready to go. You still up for it? And I said, yes. And yeah, so they published it last June.
And we are now talking about a shortlisting for the Bailey's Prize for Women's Fiction. So I'm going to pick up on shortlistings because we have three very shortlisted authors sitting at our table. Welcome back to Nuns Island Theatre and this special arena programme as part of this year's Kirch Festival. With me are Rachel Kushner, Patrick DeWitt and Emer McBride. We just had got to the point of talking about shortlistings, and Emer, yours is the most recently shortlisted novel for the Bailey's Prize for Women's Fiction. What does that mean? I guess it will help the business side of things, but what does it mean to you as a writer to get that shortlisting?
Well, I'm delighted to be up for any prizes. But it's, you know, after having such a rough journey to get to this point, it's quite nice to have a bit of recognition, I suppose.
What was the when the publisher told you you're on the shortlist? Were they very excited? Did the marketing department know how to market your book?
Amazingly, they did. Yeah. yeah. Well, if I'd had the shortlisting 9 years ago, perhaps all would have been different. Yeah, no, they were delighted, of course they were. And, you know, I started off with a really tiny publisher and who've just sold on to a bigger publisher. So there was two very happy publishers that day.
What about you, Pat? The Sisters Brothers was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize in 2011. What difference did that make for you for that book?
Well, I think what these prizes do is they get people discussing literature in a way that they normally wouldn't, discovering authors that they wouldn't normally have read. And I think being up for a prize does any number of things, but the most positive thing that I took away from it was that it forced my book into a lot of strangers' homes, and they read it, and I'm really grateful for that, you know.
And for you, Rachel, I mentioned that you're the only author that's been shortlisted twice for the National Book Award in the United States, which is a huge award. The first one, was it more exciting than the second? And what difference would you say it made for the sales of the books and for you as a writer?
Gosh, yeah, this line, the only writer ever to be nominated for both the first and second novel. I sometimes think, you know, the only writer wearing 100% cotton who was born in Oregon. It gets a little, I think the marketing department came up with that one. But I guess I'm proud. It feels quite nice, but I don't know. I wish I enjoyed that kind of news more than I do. I have strange sort of, there's some distance between me and the reception to each one of my two novels. By the time I'm finished writing the book, I have my own very personal relationship to the text and what I think is good about it and the way in which it represents me. It's really a manifestation of a lifelong being and thinking and having a sensibility and trying to corral it into, you know, some effect. And so I'm protective of what I've made, and I already know what I think about it by the time it comes out into the world. So I'm happy, but I'm actually most happy for the people in publishing who work really hard to promote books. They work long hours. They don't get paid that much money. And when your book gets nominated, it reflects well on their faith in us as writers. So I think I look at it from a more practical angle, that I feel like I've been a good girl for my publishers who work so hard. And, you know, and they deserve a break because they really put their neck out for their authors.
You bring up an interesting point, though, that the book pretty much becomes something that you build a huge relationship with. Where's the writer in the equation? The reader in the equation. Are they there at all?
That's complicated. I mean, I don't write for the reader. I feel like I have to do what I'm going to do and somehow activate all these different aspects of myself, which is, you know, the novel is a wonderful thing because it takes the whole person. It's, you know, a full engagement. But probably I am the reader when I'm writing. I want to please the kind of reader that I am. Or if you want to get psychoanalytic, you know, some other with a capital O, the subject who is supposed to know what I can do when I'm working at my best. But I'm not thinking about readers out there in the land of books. I think, not to say that I did something new, but new things are not created to please. They're created in order to create.
Well, if you want to hear more from Rachel, she will be speaking with Eleanor Catton, who is the winner of the Man Booker Prize, since we are talking about prize winners, etc. That's tomorrow evening at the Town Hall Theatre here in Galway. And the event will be chaired by Sinead Gleeson of The Book Show here on RTE Radio 1. Patrick, your event, you're talking about Words and Fables. When is that?
That's tonight, I think. At 8 o'clock.
Tonight at 8 o'clock, which magically is in a minute's time, because we talked to it this afternoon. And your event briefly and finally, Emer.
I'm afraid that was yesterday.
Well, there we go.
You've missed it already.
All right, it is time for us to go. I suppose we should briefly mark the passing of Sue Townsend, the diary of Adrian Mole. I'm sure lots of people will be very sad at her demise today. But that is our lot for this evening. Thank you to all here at Nuns Island Theatre for their help.